All right. Well, welcome back. We're continuing in 1 Samuel. Just as a reminder of where we'll be in 1 Samuel 20 today, but just as a reminder of how we got here, the shape of the last little bit. One thing we've seen is that Samuel is structured in these series of someone's on the demise and someone else is on the rise, right? So I think last week, 2020 has been a little bit like that, hasn't it? But last week I used the analogy of kind of season one was Eli's demise and Samuel's rise. And then season two was kind of Samuel fading from the picture. We're not sure if it's a demise or not, but Saul's very much on the rise. And now we're in the midst of season three, where Saul seems to be falling apart and David is in the ascendancy. We saw that especially with David's anointing and then David and Goliath and then chapter 18 and 19. And we made the observation, especially about 16, 17, and 18, that we seem to have kind of stepped out of a normal progression of time. And all of these things are happening and we're not sure when they happen in relation to each other, but the effect is to kind of have the narrator carry us along in the same kind of confused jostling that Saul seems to be experiencing over that period as he loses his grip on reality. And in chapter 19, we seem to kind of step back into a normal progression of time that will continue as we move into chapter 20 today and beyond. So some of the things we talked about in chapter 19 last week, this kind of overarching theme of Saul's pursuit of David. This animosity, this jealousy is taking a very personal and increasingly overt character. The things that happen in chapter 18, we get a view into Saul's heart. The narrator gives us that, but the things that happen, David has the ability to interpret them as just features of Saul's madness on the one hand and features of Saul's favor on the other. He doesn't immediately think, right, Saul's offering his daughter to me as a wife is a trap. We know it's a trap because the narrator gives us this glimpse into Saul's inner thoughts, but David doesn't. We move into chapter 19. And all of a sudden, it's very overt. It's not just Saul in his own private thoughts thinking these things. It's Saul telling his officers, we have to find a way to get rid of David. I want you to kill him. It's Saul, not in a moment of madness, actively pursuing David. Having thrown the spear at him again in a moment where he seems to have this fit of rage, but after he's already told his officers we need to kill him and then backed off of that and now pursues him to his house and pursues him to Ramah. So we enter into chapter 19 after that. In chapter 18, other things we saw were Jonathan siding with David, not necessarily yet against his father, talking his father back off the edge, as it were. But Michal, Saul's daughter, taking David's side and protecting him and helping him flee when she knows her father is chasing him. Both of those things together especially leave us wondering about what possibility there is for a dynasty for Saul. We already know God has said, no, that won't happen. But we're beginning to see the outworkings of that. And one thing we see in the midst of Saul's pursuit of David in chapter 19 is that David continues to respond to that without aggression. He gets out of the situations, he flees, he doesn't turn and fight at any point. He eludes and evades Saul rather than confronts him. That brings us into chapter 20. So why don't we... Yes. Yes,
right. When the spear is thrown at David,
This is a good question. So the thing with the spear being hurled at David, which happens multiple times, when it happens in chapter 18, if we turn back to chapter 18, I think we can use the headings in our Bibles, if you have one that has headings, to kind of give us a sense of what's happening. Beginning of chapter 18, David and Jonathan become very close friends. Saul becomes very jealous of David, but the description of that and the way that manifests is internal. Right, we already know that Saul is tormented by the spirit. We get the introduction to that in chapter 16. And David is brought into Saul's service to play the harp to help alleviate that. So all of the jealousy and the animosity toward David so far is all internal. So that when they're in 18:10 and following, this harmful spirit comes upon Saul, and Saul hurls a spear at David as David plays the lyre to calm him. We get a window into Saul's internal thoughts in verse 11, where it says, "And Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David evaded him twice." But from the perspective of other characters in the story, this hostile action toward David is only happening in this context where Saul is overcome with madness or being tormented by the spirit. So there's an opportunity for David and for others to interpret this as not something personal between Saul and David, but simply another manifestation of Saul's tormenting. And the way we see that play out over the rest of the chapter is Saul offers his eldest daughter to David. And again, we see the internal dialogue where Saul sees this as an opportunity to increase the danger to David from the Philistines. But he's not talking about that with his officers. He's not saying that in a way that's overheard by David. So there's this mix of there's danger to David, but only when Saul is being tormented by the Spirit. And it's balanced by this favor that Saul seems to be showing to David. So we as the readers know more than David and the other characters do, as that were. And that's one thing that's very different as we move into chapter 19. Because from the very beginning of chapter 19, it says, "And Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David." So now other characters know. Saul has expressed that to others and made it very clear. And Jonathan goes and tells David, "You're in danger. My dad wants to kill you." And then as that unfolds, Jonathan is able to walk his father back from that position. But that having surfaced and been made clear, when later in chapter 19, Saul tries to pin David to the wall with the spear again, in that moment where he's being tormented by the spirit and David's playing the lyre, David clearly senses that there's this whole other level of danger, right? Because Saul has already expressed to others that he wants to kill me. And now he's doing this again, which he's done before. And maybe it's not about the madness. Maybe it's about me. And so it's at that point when it happens again, after Saul has expressed this desire to kill him, that David flees. Right? Rather than just kind of getting out of the room and waiting for Saul to calm down and then coming back to play the lyre again. Right? At this point, because he already knows that Saul has told his officers that he wants David killed. And then Saul does this again. That's when David decides to get out of town.
Back to the offer of marriage.
Yes.
The first offer of marriage to
Merab.
Huh?
Merab. Yeah.
Merab.
Yeah, first offer of marriage to his eldest daughter.
And then next thing we hear, she has been doing help.
Yes.
Why?
Yes. Yeah.
So what's going on?
It sounds like something we've seen before, doesn't it? Now, there are multiple layers to this. This offer of a daughter who then gets married to someone else. It definitely should remind us of earlier things, right? It should remind us of Jacob with Leah and Rachel. It should remind us of Samson with the Canaanite girl. But there's more to it here in the sense that David refuses. Saul makes this offer to David, and we know from Saul's internal dialogue that he makes this offer in order to trap David. And Saul is very manipulative in the way he tries to bring this about. And David, we don't get a good sense of why David refuses. We know what David says. He does. So verse 17, back in chapter 18. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my eldest daughter, Merab. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." And another layer of this is if we go back and read chapter 17 with David and Goliath, we expected this as part of the bargain for defeating Goliath, but it doesn't happen, or it's not presented to us by the narrator as something that immediately follows the defeat of Goliath. So we're already, I think, sensing some unease here. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought. These are Saul's private thoughts, not something he expresses to others. Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. So for Saul, he's creating a trap for David in making this offer. And David said to Saul, "Who am I? And who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" Right? That sounds like David is saying no. In a very gracious, a very humble no. But Saul doesn't press it. So we're kind of left with Saul's made this offer, and David seems to be at least reluctant to accept that offer. And then we come to the next verse, which says, "But at the time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel the Meholathite for a wife." Whoever that is, which in a sense is also kind of playing off of David's, you know, who am I and who is my family? And then we get this other guy we've never heard of, whose family we've never heard of, to whom she's given. So, yes, Rose.
The phrase "at the time when she should have been given to David."
Yeah.
Because David didn't effectively, maybe he's humble about it, but he doesn't seem like he closed the door on it because she should have been given to him.
Yeah. The narrator kind of leaves that unresolved for us, right? Is David's response a no? Or is David's response simply, right, the polite, expected response of a vassal, right, who's being offered this extraordinarily splendid gift by his lord? And the narrator kind of leaves that hanging and then says, at the time she should have been given to David, right? She's given to this other guy we've never heard of. So, that's true. I should be more careful with my words. Does David refuse, or does David simply respond with the humility we would expect of a subject? And then, for whatever reason, right, Saul glosses over that, passes over that. But then we find something very interesting in the next verse. Right, now Saul's daughter Michal loved David. This is not a comment about David. This is not a comment about Saul. It is a comment about Saul, though, because all of this, the women of Israel falling in love with David and choosing him over Saul and praising him in their songs over Saul, extends all the way into Saul's household. So that this is about Michal, this is also about Saul. Right? He's He's losing his grip on so many things. He's losing his grip on the army. He's losing his grip on Israel politically. He's losing the confidence of the people. And that's, is it fair to put it that way, is difficult to nut out. But that's certainly the way he is experiencing it. He's not experiencing it as, look at this amazing choice I made in making David an officer over the soldiers, and look at how successful that decision I made has been. Instead, he's looking at it as, you know, I'm losing my fan base to this upstart. And now my own daughter's heart has gone after him. But why? Yes, the thing pleases Saul, but why, right? Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. And the next verse tells us why, right? Saul thought, let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So once again, Saul thinks this is great, but he doesn't think this is great because he loves David and thinks Michal would be great for him. He thinks this is great because here he's got another opportunity to trap David. For all of these reasons, the Philistines will be against him again. He's got an insider in David's household. Not that that works out. And the narrator kind of has Saul bringing up in his own words what Saul didn't do the first time, right? Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, you shall now be my son-in-law. Right? We're going to gloss over the whole fact that I didn't give you my eldest daughter like I said I would, and you maybe or maybe didn't decline. And Saul commanded his servants, speak to David in private. And this is Saul manipulating the situation, right? Because he doesn't want to hear from David again about how this is inappropriate for me because of my social position and who you are, like this, you know, a bird may love a fish, but where could they build a home together, right? This is not going to work out. So Saul goes to his other officers, his servants, right, and says, you guys, talk this idea up to David, right? Tell him how much I love him. Forget the fact that I told you, you know, a chapter ago that we need to kill him, right? We'll just ignore that. Or no, he hasn't done that yet, right? He doesn't do that until 19. Yeah, so his servants aren't quite that jaded, yeah? He hasn't told them that yet. So he commanded his servant, speak to David in private and say, behold, the king has delight in you and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law. And this is another element of David's confusion in the midst of this. Right? Because the only danger he's encountered from Saul is in this moment of madness. And everything that surrounds that, right, are Saul's promoting David to a high office, his including David as part of his court, his offering to David his daughter, and then his other daughter, and Saul's own servants telling David how awesome Saul thinks he is. Right? And I think that's part of why David has not already run away. Because that makes it very easy for David to interpret that danger from Saul as simply a feature of the torment Saul is experiencing, right? Like maybe he just doesn't like the lyre music. You know, maybe whoever had been there playing the lyre would have had that spear thrown at them. So, although the narrator tells us quite clearly in verse 25, right, now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. Because what does Saul want as a bride price? He wants 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Right? Think about what that takes to get, right? That's not something they're going to willingly give up, right? You need 100 dead Philistines with no one to help them and no one to guard their bodies, which means probably you need a lot more than 100 dead Philistines. And with no support coming to them either. You need 100 dead Philistines with no other comrades around to help them and no one left alive to go back and get help. That's what that requires. And David comes back with 200. So, yeah, David's like, okay, I got this, right? Which means things did not go Saul's way, right? And which, of course, just endears David that much more to the people of Israel and to Saul's court. So that chapter ends with the comment, then the commanders of the Philistines came out to battle. I imagine they're a little unhappy about this, right? And as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul. So that his name was highly esteemed, which tells you something else about David's position in Saul's court. Because we don't get the sense that this jealousy and animosity is a feature of other people's interactions with David. It seems to just be a feature of Saul's interactions with David. Saul's rise to prominence, so far as we know from what the narrator tells us, does not cause the same response among Saul's officers or among the people as it does in Saul's heart. But then there's this sudden turn in chapter 19. All right. And Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. It's not Saul's private thoughts anymore. It's Saul's policy that he wants David dead. So Jonathan steps in. Because Jonathan delights in David. And Jonathan goes and tells David, right, Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Right, you need to hide. And I need to try and, right, and Jonathan takes this extremely risky move of trying to talk his father out of this policy, which is not yet the same as publicly defying his father on this, which he will do later. Here, it's privately confronting his father and trying to change his mind, which he succeeds in doing. Right, verse 6 tells us, Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan reported to him all these things, and Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. But next time, right, in verse 9, a harmful spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. Now, when this situation happens, that Saul is overcome with his torment and David plays the lyre and Saul tries to pin him with the wall with the spear, David has an important piece of information he didn't have before, which is that at least at one point, Saul wanted him dead. And that changes how David experiences this moment where Saul throws a spear at him. Right? And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he eluded Saul so that he struck the spear into the wall. And David fled and escaped that night. So at this point, right, having gone through the experience of Jonathan telling him, Saul wants you dead, David knows it's time to leave. So, and he does so with Michael's help, right? So much for Saul's plans on how that would go. Yes, yeah. And we were left with this question last week that we kind of left unresolved. We kind of said, oh, that's interesting. Like, why is it that there's this stone idol that happens to be available in David's household that can be used as part of the making it look like someone is sick in bed? Laying there. And the narrator just kind of is not surprised by that and doesn't expect you to be and just keeps going. He certainly doesn't comment on it as something commendable. something fortuitous in the circumstances, perhaps. Yeah, begin to use an image for something, right? May as well use it for this. It's not exactly showing reverence to the stone image. But there are several times something like that happens, just in passing, that the narrator is not surprised by. And sometimes I think we don't stop long enough to be surprised by it ourselves. But we end up with these arguments and with archaeologists that are unnecessary. Because archaeologists will dig things up in Palestine and they'll say, look, the Israelites were polytheists. The Bible is wrong. And I want to say, like, neither you nor the people arguing with you have actually read the Old Testament. Because that's what it tells you about these people. And we see it all over the place. We see it spoken against. We see it called out as sinful and wrong. But we see it all over the place, right? And it's not just the prophets. You certainly can't read the prophets without getting that picture. But you also, right, it just pops up as a matter of course in Samuel. Like, oh, there's an idol in the house. Anyway. And we end 1 Samuel 19, as we talked about, with a second explanation for this proverbial question. Is Saul also among the prophets? We saw it at the very beginning with Saul when he's looking for the donkeys back in chapter 10. And then we see it again here in chapter 19, where Saul has some kind of overwhelming spiritual experience as he approaches Samuel, or leaves Samuel, and encounters a school of prophets, as it were, where he's overwhelmed and he prophesies along with others. Which is very interesting. It kind of bookends Saul's reign, as it were. At the very beginning, before he's proclaimed king, and now at the very end, as things have obviously kind of run their course, but he's not quite yet ousted. So, and then that brings us to chapter 20.
In your lesson last week, I listened to your recording, and this thing here in verse 24,
yes,
you have a question mark about whether he also stripped off his clothes and he took off the side before Samuel and laid down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, you said, they said, he saw also the prophet. Question mark about is this stripping off your clothes and laying it out naked, is this normal part of the delivering or receiving a prophetic message? Left question mark on that. So I'm wondering.
Yep. Yeah, I did. I left that as a question mark. You know, the whole getting naked and laying down, exposed to the elements all day long and all night. Is that normal? Well, I don't know. We don't see it expressly mentioned in other places. It's not that there's no nudity anywhere else in the prophets at all. We certainly see it in other places, especially as a sign act. Right? I think it's Isaiah. Who walks naked for a time as a sign of what will be done to the Egyptians as they're taken into exile. Ezekiel lies naked on his side as he kind of has this little model siege diorama, right, with the little Lego wall, right? So, for a long time. But as what seems to be a part of the spiritual experience of the prophets, and involved in their prophesying, I don't know.
I wonder if there's anything, any relationship to Noah. That's the first example. Laying aside his robe
Well, we're told why Noah does that. Right, Noah's drunk. And he also thinks he's alone inside his tent.
Right.
Yeah. There is, I think, in the shame element, because I think the first time we get this proverbial question, there's a sense of amazement and wonder, right? Saul has embarked on this journey. Saul has encountered Samuel. Saul has been anointed as the coming king. And then he has this experience as the Spirit rushes upon him and he prophesies. And so is Saul also among the prophets? It's kind of a, wow, what could this mean for us as a people? This could be an amazing moment. But here, Saul has gone in pursuit of David, whom everyone loves except Saul. Saul has been confounded in that pursuit. And the outcome of him trying to pursue David and those who had helped him flee is he's overcome and he's laying there naked, babbling, right? Prophesying all day and all night. And so it takes on a very different tone to ask that question. Is Saul also among the prophets? It's a sarcastic and biting question at this point in Saul's reign. It's a way of saying, right, the prophets are often associated with an idea of madness. And so here to ask that question is not, can we expect great things from him? It's, has he just completely lost all of his marbles? Which we see in there, in a sense, this is kind of an undoing of Saul, where he lays there shamed and defenseless and inarticulate. Yeah, much like the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah. A briefer period, I reckon. But here, being found among the prophets is equivalent to being reduced to nothing. So, which, interestingly enough, David has no hand in. Right? David continues to flee and to evade and elude Saul. And this experience that comes on Saul that reduces him to this state is the work of God and not of David. Which we're told expressly in verse 23, right? He's trying to find Samuel. He's trying to find David. He's going after both of them at this point. And verse 23 tells us that he went there to Naioth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also. And as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naioth and Ramah. And he too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night. So this state that he's reduced to is not the result of David's opposition. It's the result of God's opposition. Which in a sense puts a clear public divine stamp on the demise of Saul's reign. So, and I think very artfully the narrator, by making that clear here, we already know where Saul is going because Samuel's made that very clear. And now Saul's grip on everything, which has been kind of slowly unraveling, the pace has now drastically increased. But the narrator is making clear for us that this is not the result of David's opposition. This continues to be the result of a work of God in opposing Saul in his office. So, I think that's helpful. So what we saw in chapter 19, culminating here in David's non-aggression and his response to Saul, is something to watch for. Right? Is this something that continues? Because what are we used to in these kinds of power struggles between leaders near the top of nations, right? We don't see non-aggression, right? When we see someone who is in charge become suspicious of one of their officers about the possibility of a coup or perhaps the reality of a coup and the power struggle that ensues, we don't see, not never, but hardly ever do we see the one accused responding without any kind of aggression or violence, right? Merely pulling back, merely escaping. What we usually see is a match of force with force and an escalation, which results not just in a bloody power struggle, but results in the destruction of the nation that they're vying for control over. So, but it'll be interesting to watch as we continue next week, I guess, into chapter 20 and beyond, to watch and see if that remains a feature of David's response to Saul. And there's a sense in which, right, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, they're not new to us. They're books we've read before. But in reading them carefully, look at the ways in which that's brought forward, right? And the things that you think about how 1 and 2 Samuel work based on having read them before, right? Watch carefully and see if the details support that or run counter to that or put a different spin on that than you expected. Rose. Yes and no. That's a non-answer to your question, right? So when David comes to the moment to transfer power to one of his sons, is there a precedent in Israel's own history or in the history of surrounding peoples in this idea of kingship? Is there a precedent for like a peaceful transfer of power? To which I would say yes and no. Oh, so could Saul have seen an example that would... Yeah, although between David's sons, it's...
Right.
Yeah, there's no small amount of tension there. But for Saul, it's a different question. Because Saul rules as king and is, in his mind, being opposed by one of his subjects. So that, from his perspective, there's no possibility of peaceful transfer there. Right? But Saul has demonstrated over the course of his reign that he is not willing to submit to God's authority when it... when it's not in his perceived best interest to do so. So I think we see things like that with the judges in a sense, but the nature of their leadership is very different. It's temporary. It's designed usually to meet specific threats, and someone is empowered by the Spirit, either for their lifetime, but with no expectation of a dynasty, or for a specific task, where the Spirit will rush upon them. They're empowered to lead for this time, and then Israel is essentially without a leader. And Saul experiences that with the Lord rushing upon him, right? He's empowered to do this work, to deliver Israel from the Philistines. But the expectation of this office of kingship, what the Israelites expected to get out of it, was a relative stability in leadership and the continued line of kings. So no, in that sense, that because of the different nature of the office, how that works itself out in the history of surrounding nations to which the Israelites are looking as they're saying, we want a king. There's no real model for so-and-so's kingship has run their course, and so they need to pass the baton of kingship on to one of their officers. So, and what we see instead is a continued cycle of coups. But we see this with Absalom. When he tries to take over power from David, one of the things he does, which strikes us as either weird or horrid, is just a regular feature of ancient Near Eastern kingship and struggles of power, is when you defeat a king, one of the ways you proclaim your victory over them is by taking their wives as your own, which is what happens to David's concubines whom he leaves as he flees Jerusalem, right? Absalom sets up a tent and sleeps with them in the sight of all Israel, as it were. And that's not just, right? The narrator mentions that in doing so, he kind of makes himself a stench to David, right? That takes away any possibility of reconciliation there. But he's also doing that as proclaiming that what was David's is now mine. Yeah, when Adonijah wants David's concubine, that's part of what's under the surface there. Because if Adonijah can get David's concubine, then that is, in a sense, his proclaiming that what was my father's is now mine. So, all right, well, we'll get into chapter 20 next week, I suppose. Thank you.